This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This was a big week with terrorist attacks in Brussels, Belgium, and America's president taking a visit to Cuba. We've covered those stories extensively on Trumpet Radio and at thetrumpet.com this week. But there were also a lot of other important stories that we want to bring you up to speed on. We have our panel of writers ready to discuss this past week's most significant events. Here in the studio, we have Robert Morley.
Good morning. Great to be here. Today, we'll talk a little bit about a drug epidemic that many people have ignored and are continuing to ignore, but it's actually harming more people than heroin.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Thanks for having me on the show. Time really does fly, but we'll be talking about a big geopolitical anniversary from this past week, the two-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Crimea.
We also have Anthony Chibodidwe.
Greetings. Today we'll talk about Al-Qaeda's lethal comeback in Africa, and in the wake of the Brussels attack, we'll talk about what it means for Africa and what it means for Europe.
And also via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. I can't really talk about the news in Europe this week without discussing the terrorist attacks in Brussels. We're going to talk about where they're leading and how Europe is beginning to respond.
Well, let's get straight into it. We do need to start with that, the biggest story of the week, these terrorist attacks that happened Tuesday morning in the capital of the European Union. As I said, we've had quite a lot of coverage all week on thetrumpet.com, but we are beginning to get more of a sense of how Europe is going to respond to this attack. Stephen Fleury covered this morning on his Trumpet Daily Radio show. But to tell us more about it, we're going to turn to our man in Britain, Richard.
Well, the big impact of Brussels is that it's really driving home to Europe that they've got to change. You know, this isn't just going to go away. After London 2005, there was a gap of around 10 years where there were no mass casualty attacks in Europe conducted by Islamists. And now we've had three in quick succession. You know, there's a saying that goes something like, once is fluke, twice is coincidence, three times is a trend. And so although this is a smaller attack than Paris with fewer casualties, and there's less, I'd say, of a sense of shock after this attack, there's much more of a sense of, okay, we need to make a lot of changes. And there's a lot more discussion, especially within the press. We're only just starting to get the first kind of initial thoughts from European leaders, but a lot definitely in the press that Europe needs to make some changes now. It can't just hope that these attacks are going to stop.
So what are some of the changes that are being suggested at this point?
Well, one of the big focuses, especially from the news media after this attack, is Belgium is kind of a developed, semi-failed state. Belgium was highly implicated in the planning of the Paris attack. Now, then you had, you know, then just last week we found out that the main terrorists had been hiding out in Belgium for several months, undetected. You had this attack in Belgium. And so there's this real sense that that Belgium has a serious problem.
Now, the specific neighborhood that Mr. Fleury focused on his program, this, I forget the name of it, the neighborhood where that really has been a hive of this kind of planning and activity, you're talking about something even broader than just that.
That's right. That there's, there's problems within policing, but then there's problems even just within the makeup of the state itself. You know, we kind of, a few years ago, Belgium went some 530 odd days without a government. And we kind of had a good laugh at that at the time. Haha, they've gone a year and a half, no government. That's kind of funny. Well, now this is the consequences of a modern nation that can go a year and a half without having a government.
This is what flourishes in the absence of strong leadership.
Strong leadership, a strong national identity as well. I mean, when your nation is split entirely between people that identify primarily as Dutch-speaking Flemish or French-speaking Walloons, then what's an Islamic-speaking immigrant? How are they going to become a proud Belgian? Where do they fit into that picture? You've got that, and then you've got the fact that until recently, Brussels alone had 19 different police departments. This linguistic split has added all these layers of bureaucracy. Now they've got 6 police departments, but they've still got 19 mayors. And it really makes policing incredibly inefficient. And one of the points that Rob and I brought out in the article we've got in the Trumpet Weekly, Belgium attacked, Europe under attack, is, I was quoting from an analyst on Vox, that makes the point that Belgium is now Europe's national security equivalent of Greece. With the Greece crisis, you had a nation that didn't control their economy, and it threatened to bring down economies across Europe. Now you've got Belgium as a nation that cannot control its national security, and that's threatening to bring down national security across Europe. And this author, Matthew Liglesias, he made the point that what you'll see now is the same reaction that we had to Greece, but on a national security level. Other nations saying, if Belgium doesn't get it under control, we're going to get hurt. And so you're going to see Belgium faced with the decision, ultimately, you'll be cut off from Schengen, or you need to allow us much greater oversight into your police force, perhaps even allow our police in there, much greater influence on all of Belgium's policing and national security. And it won't just be Belgium either. Just like with the Greece crisis, it meant putting in place economic systems that affected the whole of Europe. We're going to see the same happen with Belgium.
So this idea of collective security, that's a really helpful analogy, just to talk about the alignment between the way that people were talking about we've got to resolve the economic problems that Greece is experiencing with a Europe-wide solution. Now they're talking about collective security with respect to the problems within Belgium. Give us some specifics about what the leaders are saying about how to resolve this or how to pursue that collective security idea.
Okay, right. Yeah. The other point I'll just make quickly, of course, is just like the Euro crisis wasn't just Greece's problem, they were just the worst. It's the same with Belgium. Paris has a problem. Germany has a problem. So they are going to need this for a whole bunch of other countries too. But Jean-Claude Juncker yesterday, he talked about how we've got all of these other unions in place, a capital market union, an energy union, economic monetary union. But he said, we also think we need a security union. We need everything that will allow us to achieve a security union. And Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, he called for a European pact for freedom and security. And France has been pushing for this since the Paris attacks, quite understandably. And they had a meeting of EU interior ministers on Thursday, and he pushed really hard again for that at the start of that meeting. So we're seeing this same push for this security union. Now, the only reason we might not have heard more on that is, and this also illustrates how much Europe has to change, a lot of the authorities, the organizations that would deal with this are currently on holiday because it's the Easter weekend. So I think we'll hear more about that starting next week, and we'll also probably see some changes whereby less of Europe shuts down when it's a bank holiday weekend as well.
This article you draw attention to in the Trumpet Weekly, where it's David Ignatius, he's making this comparison with some of the intelligence sharing and security cooperation that occurred in World War I after the Pearl Harbor attack, and how we need to return to that kind of model. And he's talking about specifically a transatlantic cooperation, but really we should expect to see more of this within the continent of Europe, it sounds like.
Yes, and I think that's, even from the transatlantic point of view, America is, their kind of big beef is wanting Europe to step it up. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been much more into privacy and complaining about the NSA. And I think from America's point of view, the only way that they're going to be able to have this kind of transatlantic cooperation, they're open to it, but they're wanting Europe to step it up to get its act together. And so that, I think they're going to be pressuring exactly the same. They're going to be pressuring for that as well. They're going to be saying, come on, Europe, you need to have better intelligence sharing. You need to have a Europe-wide crime agency, some kind of European FBI or a beefing up of Europol. And I think they're probably going to be pushing for this just as hard, if not even harder, than the Europeans are doing.
Yeah, I was going to add to that, and I think you just touched on it just a second ago, but we kind of had a similar movement here in America back like 1890s, to where we had this like an anarchist movement that they, and one of them shot President McKinley. And so kind of in response to that, President Theodore Roosevelt had instituted this FBI to police interstate crimes on a federal level, which before McKinley was shot, there would have been a big pushback against that because the states didn't want to give up power to the federal government to take over policing functions. But that was kind of a crisis that spurred the creation of our federal police force. And I was wondering if Europe's maybe not seeing something very similar to that with this Islamic terrorist problem.
It really is a consistent theme that we're seeing, that it's crisis that drives unification. You've seen it on an economic level and just the pressure on trying to unify more economically. And to think that it's these kinds of threats that would be driving a more federalized, unified policing is really no surprise.
I completely agree. And that's why I think one of the most important articles we have in the Trumpet Weekly is one by John R. Schindler. In the same kind of section about how Europe will respond, called Europe is Again at War. And he really does a great job of illustrating the scale of the crisis that Europe is now experiencing. And a lot of these changes, they're going to get started with these Brussels attacks. But, you know, he makes the point, this isn't just terrorism. This is something that resembles more like a low-intensity guerrilla warfare that Europe is facing. And you know, he goes back to some military exercises. 2012, I remember writing about this for the Trumpet back then. Switzerland was actually conducting military exercises to prepare for civilization almost falling apart in modern European countries, for waves of refugees coming up their border and their army needing to keep them out. Then 2013, they did a drill to prepare for France trying to invade to get money out of French citizens' banks and Swiss bank accounts. And so they've been sounding warnings, and he makes the same point that the Swiss have been saying, that, you know, Brussels has an army about 3,000 strong. If this gets worse, and he points out the real worst case scenario, if you get some kind of far right person like Anders Breivik targeting Muslims, and you get a far right group targeting Muslims, and it descends into all out war and anarchy, a 3,000 strong Belgium army is not going to be anywhere near capable of keeping the peace. And so there is the threat of massive unrest, and then that would bring about very quickly a lot of these steps. And that actually goes back to some statements Mr. Gerald Flurry made in the aftermath of the Greek crisis, where you had a similar social unrest. And you know, he wrote, social unrest and riots will eventually force Europeans to succumb to a strong, united government of Europe, led ultimately not from Brussels, but from Berlin. And so there's the potential for things to get pretty desperate from this terrorist threat, to the point that they would even be inviting in other people's police and perhaps even other people's armies.
It's fascinating to watch this develop. The wording in one of the pillar prophecies that we refer to so often, Daniel 11, it's very important, where it talks about a radical Islamic power pushing at this European empire, and it's that push that provokes this dramatic response. And we're already seeing that in so many ways in embryo. Europe is being provoked, and you get the sense that they wouldn't be taking these measures if it weren't for these pushes against them. The cover story in this week's Trumpet Weekly from Robert Morley and Richard Palmer, Belgium Attacked, Europe Under Attack, really good article to read. And I would encourage you to go online to thetrumpet.com and take a look at the Trumpet Weekly. We appreciate you bringing that story to our attention, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The source of this Islamic terrorism is in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And we're going to look at recent events happening closer to that source. For this story, we'll go to Anthony.
Yes, Mr. Hilika, the comment that you made a comment about the prophecy in the Bible, and that specific prophecy mentioned some African nations. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, because it is very significant. Defense officials from 27 African and Arab countries met this week in Egypt to discuss this problem of terrorism, and how they could cooperate more in their counterterrorism measures. And they talked openly about how worried they are. They are worried about this problem, and it appears that their biggest concern is Al-Qaeda's devastating comeback in Western Africa and Northern Africa. Now, obviously, Al-Qaeda is not new to Africa. It has a branch that's called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is linked to the Benghazi terrorist attacks in Libya. Now, this group is also part of a coalition of terrorists that was responsible for taking over half of the nation of Mali back in 2012. Probably most people had never heard about Mali. They didn't know Mali was a country until that attack, because it was such a big attack. Terrorists taking over half the country. In fact, over half the country. It was a territory that was as big as France or as big as Texas. And they took control of it. And it was primarily because of that attack that the French realized that they had to do something about that. And thankfully, the French intervened and pushed back a lot of those terrorists. But you're seeing now Al-Qaeda is gaining more and more influence in these weak African nations that have unstable governments. So they are taking advantage of it. It's not a situation that's different from that neighborhood in Brussels, where terrorists are taking advantage of weak systems within a government and carving out a safe haven for themselves. Now, we know what France did in Mali in 2012. They cannot afford to have terrorists create a safe haven for themselves, because that will become the next launch pad for more terrorist attacks. So France intervened in Mali in 2012, and now we're seeing Al-Qaeda making a comeback. What more are we going to see from Europe, from France? A lot of these terrorists, they're attacking French interests in Mali and in North Africa and West Africa, and they might even breed terrorists that even go into Europe to attack.
Did you have any comment, Richard?
Sure. Yeah. Well, one point I was, just thinking about. Well, firstly, it's also worth remembering that Germany is hugely invested within Mali. They have, they've taken over the police training mission in Mali, military training mission in Mali. It's one of their biggest deployments. They're the main European partner over there. The main, most of the troops over there are German. It'll be interesting to see if they have any response to this. It's been overshadowed a bit by the terrorist attack from Brussels. But the other important point to remember as we talk about Al-Qaeda in North Africa is a lot of these groups, Al-Qaeda is the brand name that they adopted. So Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, until 2007, they were the Salafist group for preaching and combat. And then some of these groups have allied with Islamic State. Some have called themselves Islamic State. But really, they're just kind of Islamists that will adopt the brand name of whoever is the most famous radical Islamist group at the time. And so, Anthony started out by talking about this clash between the King of the North and the King of the South, and Iran, we know, is the King of the South, and that the prophecies about them taking over this area. A lot of these groups have accepted Iranian weapons in the past, Iranian money, training, help. And so they're willing to work with Iran. And I think once you see Iran come to the fore, and really, well, it really is in the fore, but it's once you see Iran taking the lead and the focus coming off Islamic State, I think you'll see a lot of those groups very quickly swing around to be open allegiance with Iran. And then, you could have that prophecy fulfilled very, very quickly indeed.
Well, thanks for that story, Anthony and Richard. We're really tracking a number of problems that Europe is facing that are exposing its need for more unification, for more robust leadership. For our next story, we're going to look at another of these issues. This is an important but far less reported on story. This past Wednesday marked the 2-year anniversary of Russia invading and annexing Crimea, formerly part of Ukraine. And the world has really accepted this as just the new reality, but information came out this week about what Russia has been up to there, especially recently, that shows why we need to keep our eyes on Crimea. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, this really is an underreported on story. I think it was last month sometime, Charles Krauthammer had a piece saying that Russia's absorbed Crimea so thoroughly that the world doesn't even talk about it anymore. But there was, time flies by quickly, there was an anniversary this month. It's kind of hard to pin down an exact date, but they had a celebration on the 18th in Crimea to celebrate their two-year anniversary of being part of Russia. So it's been 2 years now that Putin's controlled this peninsula. So they had a conference in Ukraine this month in Kiev on March 14th, entitled The Militarization of the Occupied Crimea as a Threat to International Security. And this really brought out some shocking statistics on how Putin's used that 2 years of control. They said the number of troops in Crimea has gone from like 12,000 to 24,000. It's doubled. They've cited Russian plans that they actually want to get 50,000 people supporting the Black Sea fleet, the Russian Black Sea fleet that's currently docked in Crimea. They've installed complex missile systems with a targeting range able to hit Romania, Bulgaria, or Turkey. They brought out points that they said they've actually already been using this Russian sea base to send fuel into to Syria to help Putin's war there. So it's they had a really good phrase. They said he's almost militarized this entire peninsula and just turned it into a giant aircraft carrier that you can't sink because it's a peninsula that he can just use to launch planes, send missiles, amass troops. A lot of the troops, even Russian forces in eastern Ukraine that are even fighting a civil war up there now, will come back to Crimea for rest and medical attention before they go back. So he's using this to project power even into the civil war in Ukraine and even down into Syria already.
Yeah, really remarkable strategic land there that he can use to project power down into the Middle East and elsewhere in the region.
Right, yeah, he can definitely. I think George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures had a few good articles this week about how the Ukraine crisis and the Syrian crisis aren't like two different crises that Putin's managing with each hand. They're part of a bigger overall strategy to project power into the Mediterranean and southern Europe. He uses this port in Crimea to send supplies down into Syria, and he's mostly in Syria for another port that he's militarizing just as much, or in the process of militarizing just as much, that he can use to put pressure on Europe's southern border.
So it is another instance, definitely, of something that would be truly alarming to Europeans, and the people in Ukraine in particular would be alarmed to see just what a robust military buildup he is making there, right on their south. And it'll be interesting to watch this continue to develop. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. Opioid pain medications are in common use in America, so much so that opioid addiction and overdose have reached epidemic levels. That's the assessment of the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. This is a real concern, and the FDA took steps this week to address it. To tell us about this, we're going to turn to Robert Morley.
Yes, thank you. So this really is just a terrible tragedy that is affecting thousands of people in, killing thousands of people each year in America. Millions are addicted to these types of drugs. Opioids are a type of class of painkillers that are routinely prescribed by doctors within the medical industry to people that are suffering pain due to other diseases and other unrelated factors. Each year in America, I think the latest data showed that around 30,000 people died. I think that was in 2014 in related to being addicted to these drugs, not being able to get off of them. Just for context, that's more people dying due to opioid addiction than people dying in car crashes in America each year. There's over 2.1 million Americans that are addicted to these kind of drugs. Over 36 million people worldwide that are abusing these drugs. So it's about, in America, there's four times more people addicted to these opioids drugs than there are to people addicted to heroin, which is a terrible, terrible drug on its own that's related to these opioids drugs that are being prescribed by the medical industry. So this really is just an epidemic. And this week, the Food and Drug Administration came out and said, we're finally going to acknowledge that this is a problem, and we're going to do something about it. So what did they decide to do? They're going to change the labels on these drugs. They're going to make it more obvious the addiction that can result when you take these drugs. And a lot of people are saying, this is just way too little, way too late. Whistleblowers have been coming out trying to get the Food and Drug Administration's attention on this issue for many, many years. This is something that's been going back more than a decade now, that insiders knew this was a problem, that it was destroying people's lives.
So what's going to be the effect of this? I mean, labeling a bottle of painkillers and saying, look, this is a bigger problem than you might think, is that going to solve anything?
That's exactly what critics are saying. They're wondering that. They're saying, is this the best that the FDA can do to make the printing on the labels a little bigger, make it stand out a little bigger? Is that really going to affect people's lives? I mean, this is really is just a life destroyer for so many people who are addicted to these opioids. I knew a story of a lady who, 70 years old, lived in this house. She had purchased when it was brand new on a 30-year mortgage. She's paying it off. She gets on these drugs. She can't get off. Her daughter's living with her. She gets on these drugs. She can't get off. Her granddaughter is addicted to these drugs. Can't get off. Their life starts degrading to the point where they stop making their mortgage payments for their house. Their mortgage payment for their house is like $200 a month. They're getting welfare from the government, thousands of dollars between the three of them. And it's just ruined their lives so much, they can't keep it together enough to make the mortgage payments. And that example might sound extreme, but those are the kind of things that are happening to, as the stats show, to tens of thousands, if not millions of people across America today.
Well, thank you for that, Robert. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about some more aggressive steps that China is taking in the South China Sea and beyond. Some steps that China is also taking in Chicago, of all places. We'll also talk about some cyber attacks against U.S. targets from a source that's supposed to be a newfound ally, I think. And as we look at the potential for Britain to leave the EU, we're going to make some comparisons between Britain's current leaders and those of a few generations past. All of those stories after the break. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Let's talk about China. We have a couple stories about this Asian giant, a giant that's growing more formidable all the time. First, we're going to look at an aspect of this trend that we've been following for some time, Beijing taking over the South China Sea. And for this story, we will go back to Andrew Miller.
This is a trend we've covered a lot here at the Trumpet Radio program and on the Trumpet website and in our Trumpet print magazine. It's just a world-changing trend that a lot of people aren't recognizing. You'll even see a lot in the American media where people are just really wondering, like, well, why should I care if China's militarizing the South China Sea? So it's got China's name in it. China can do whatever they want with their own China Sea. But it's in Indonesia, though, I think people have a little bit more of a sense of just how real this is. And we have one article in our Trumpet Weekly this week from the Jakarta Post entitled Maritime Colonialism with Chinese Characteristics, that this just really brings this out, that he says not only is China like taking over other sovereign nations in the South China Sea, like the Philippines and Indonesia and Vietnam and other places, but they're militarizing what's arguably one of the world's most important trade routes in an attempt to just completely reshape the world's economic system. There's like $5 trillion worth of global trade flows through the South China Sea. $1 trillion of it coming from Asian nations to us here in America. That's actually like, it's like over 30% of our imports to America come through that sea. And it's just that if China has all these military bases, they have a complete lockdown on world trade, or at least that huge portion of world trade. And they bring out in this article that said when you combine that with the new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, this is a new bank China and Russia have just set up this year as like a rival to the World Bank and trying to position themselves to get to the point where the yuan could be a reserve currency. So combined with that financial bank, with this complete lockdown on world trade. So it said completing the two of them, you really could see a new economic order with China as a major player.
It's remarkable to watch this develop. This is obviously an area that the United States has been a huge, huge guarantor of security for a lot of these Asian nations, and they're having to recalculate based on America's disappearance from the region and China's ascendance, and with nobody really there to stop them.
Right, and there's even another. This is from like a year ago, but just a shocking point where George Friedman, who he was the CEO of Stratford at the time, he since moved on to Geopolitical Futures, but he was giving it a conference lecture. Where he said probably the greatest external threat to America is the fact that the European Union economic bloc could decide to join with this Asian investment bank instead of the American alliance. He said most politicians talk about Islamism as the greatest threat to America. And he said, and it is a threat, but he said, it's not really a threat that's going to wipe America off the map. But he said, if you can get this European economic bloc ever decides to like switch teams and head over to this new Asian economic bloc with their control of these major trade routes through the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean, they could completely freeze you out of world trade if that's what they chose to do.
Which is exactly what we have expected. We've been talking about the probability or the biblical's prophecies of that kind of a blockade or exactly being frozen out the way that you're describing. So to see that actually coming to pass, he was talking about it as if it's yet future, but European nations did join in with the AIIB, and that we can expect to see greater trade relationships continue to develop between Europe and Asia. And as China's economic might continues to rise, then its incentive to increase those relationships only grows. Very interesting to watch. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review, another recent story regarding China. This has been developing for over a month now, but more information came out this week that really should be of deep concern to America. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Robert.
Yeah, we were just talking about China's economic colonialism and military colonialism in the South China Sea and area. We're really seeing China make big advances economically, even on this side of the Pacific Ocean and even in Europe as well. This past month, remember, it was found out that a little-known Chinese group had made an offer to buy the Chicago Stock Exchange. This really set off a bit of a fear on Capitol Hill. A lot of lawmakers said, hey, we need to look into this. Who are these guys? It turned out they were actually owned by the Chinese government. So here's the Chinese government trying to buy the Chicago Stock Exchange.
Are there ever Chinese companies that make these kinds of acquisitions without the assent of the Chinese government?
Well, that's a great point. When you talk about big Chinese corporations, almost always they have an element of state ownership attached to them, and especially if they're making acquisitions overseas. And that really is an important point you bring up, because we have seen just a wave of Chinese corporations going on a buying spree, really a buying spree of U.S. and European companies that some people have described as epic in proportion. I think this so far this year, there's been over $100 billion spent by Chinese companies buying U.S. corporations and buying European corporations this year. This is a record year. And it comes on top of last year, which was also a record year. And it comes on top of 2014, which was also a record year. And a lot of people are looking at this and just asking, what is going on here? Why is China buying so many companies? And a lot of iconic companies, too. In the news, it was recently, there's been a lot of talk about the hotel groups, strategic hotels and resorts. And the other one, Starwood Hotels and Resorts, that's a Chinese insurance company buying into hotels. We had General Electric sell off its appliance business, you know, all the dryers and washing machines and fridges, all those that it makes, those are now all owned by a Chinese company. We've seen Chinese technology giants buying up U.S. corporations. We saw Ingram Micro, which is a $6 billion U.S. Microchip maker. It was sold out just recently to a Chinese. So they're making all kinds of acquisitions
now
in the United States.
This acquisition of the Chicago Stock Exchange, first of all, how close is this deal to actually going through? You have lawmakers trying to at least explore and look into who are these people that want to acquire it? How close is it to going through? And second, what are we talking about in terms of security implications? I mean, it's one thing for them to buy a company that's making a product, but it's another to have that their hooks into our economic system itself in the form of a stock exchange, right?
Right, absolutely. If this was not an election year, I suspect that this deal would get pushed through. However, since it is an election year and it's been brought up by some of the candidates, there's a chance that it will get canceled. Here's what...
Shining a spotlight on it that wouldn't otherwise be there.
Absolutely. With Trump, with his talk about, you know, trade with China and China kicking our butts in trade and those sorts of things, I think that there's a possibility it will get squashed. But here's what the members of Congress wrote to the Treasury Department. They wanted the Treasury Department to investigate. They said, this proposed acquisition would be the first time a Chinese-owned state-influenced firm maintained direct access to America's $22 trillion U.S. equity marketplace. So if they do get their hands on this exchange, it's going to give them access to financial information on U.S. companies that they've never, ever had in the past. Now, I think it would have gone through because the Chicago Exchange is considered a small exchange in America. It's not one of the big ones. And I think just the relationship
between... $22 trillion.
Well, the marketplace is 22, but if you look at the Chicago Exchange itself, it's much smaller. It's not on the scale of the New York Stock Exchange or, you know, the NASDAQ or something.
And there's no connections between those two in terms of exchanged information.
Well, there sure is. And that's what the lawmakers are bringing up. And that's what they're worried about. They're saying we're living in a world in which China is conducting espionage on the United States on a grand scale. We've come out and we've recently said that, you know, if China conducts cyber warfare on us, that's a red line. Well, why would we go ahead and give them access to our markets in a way they've never had it before? So this is an issue that I think a lot of people are rightfully concerned about.
The fact that we've witnessed these cyber attacks, you're referring to the ones last year where they were finding information on millions of federal employees and American citizens, that demonstrate their will to collect this information. So the fact that this would even be on the table as a possibility that a Chinese company would get this kind of access to our financial markets, it doesn't make sense at all.
It doesn't. I mean, you mentioned that one. There's been many, many cases infiltrating security systems of electric facilities, power generating facilities, stealing the plans for the F-35, the physical dimensions of the plane that we talked about, that Richard talked about last week. I mean, this is an ongoing war that's happening. So when a state-owned company comes after something that is such a potentially a strategic in nature as a stock exchange, you have to be very, very careful. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that. But I think just before we go, I know we're running out of time here, one other thing that I think this could be foreshadowing, that this massive buying spree from China. It started 2 years ago before China devalued its currency. And it was the single biggest devaluation of its currency in its history. You know, over the course of a week, Chinese products became like 5 or 6% cheaper than Americans. And they stole a whole bunch of trade. These are the kind of things Donald Trump is talking about. I think this could be indicating that China's getting ready to devalue its currency again. Basically, they're letting their big companies come out and spend their yuans before they become worth less. And then once they devalue, they'll be able to repatriate that money back if they so choose, and they'll make a lot on the transaction. So all this hot money that's coming into America, buying all these corporations, that could just as that's helping our economy at the time, that could just as quickly flood back out the other way.
Tremendous amount of economic power that China has because of the amount of currency, the amount of dollars that it has, and the way it's able to manipulate the dollar and the markets globally. Really tremendous amount of power that it has at its disposal that it's willing and ready to use. Well, thanks for that story, Robert. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Attacks against America aren't just coming from Asia. Another ongoing story that we've been following is Iran's behavior since the nuclear deal was reached last year, implemented this past January 16th. Well, yesterday, the Justice Department reached a verdict regarding some Iranians that goes back before the nuclear deal was struck, but that really gives us an alarming look at just what kind of an enemy the U.S. is dealing with and treating as a negotiation partner. For this story, we'll go to Anthony.
Yes, as you say, the United States indicted 7 Iranians who were involved in cyber terrorist attacks. They attacked 46 financial institutions in the United States. And some of those include the Bank of America, the NASDAQ, and the New York Stock Exchange. And they also attacked a dam in New York. Now, these hackers conducted these attacks between 2011 and 2013. So it's really nothing new. We have reported about this. Richard Palmer recently wrote about it in a recent Trumpet magazine article. But 5 years is a long time to start trying to deal with a serious attack like this, especially coming from the number one state sponsor of terrorism. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said these attacks were relentless, they were systematic, and they were widespread. And they were intended to cripple the United States economy. Now, bad things happen when an economy is crippled, and the ramifications go well beyond just the economics. Now, all these attacks that I mentioned on the financial institutions, they were these so-called distributed denial-of-service attacks where these hackers are overwhelming computer systems with the requests, and then the end result is that usually those computers, they crash. So that's exactly what happened. And I mentioned the nature of these attacks because it's easy for some people to just dismiss those attacks as fairly harmless.
Right, it takes computers down for a few hours and you're able to restore service.
Yeah, we've become so used to cyber terrorist attacks, right? China is doing that all the time. And as you mentioned, they've been stealing defense information, very sensitive information. So it's easy to dismiss that as just as a fairly harmless attack. But this attack cost us tens of millions of dollars. It cost us a lot of money. And as even the Department of Justice said, it was intended to destroy the American economy. Now, the second attack on the dam was even more sinister because these hackers gained control of the dam's water level monitoring systems, and they could have flooded parts of New York. They could have done that. The only reason why they didn't is that the dam's computer systems just happened to be offline because of maintenance. It was just a coincidence that it happened that way. Otherwise, the intention was to flood parts of New York. And this is a very scary situation. That's one of the attorneys in New York said, it's like it's coming from a movie script. It's very scary. And there could have been a lot of damage caused by these Iranians, sponsored by the Iranian government, who have ties to the Revolutionary Guards. And yeah, this has been going on for years.
So there's a whole lot of American infrastructure, dams and other major components of our energy grids and our electrical and communication systems that if hackers are able to infiltrate those systems and actually take control of them, not only could it be used for espionage, but it could be used to shut us down. In this particular case, you're talking about flooding parts of New York, putting citizens' lives at risk just with an immediate physical threat, a whole lot of options that they would have at their disposal. And you're saying the Iranian Revolutionary Guard was able to actually, I mean, we don't tend to think of Iran as being one of the giants of cyber espionage, but here they made it work.
And remember, they did it for 2 years. For 2 years, they were doing it constantly. It was relentless all the time, constantly. For 2 years, they were doing this over and over and over again, attacking our infrastructure. They could, who knows what else they were working on, maybe nuclear power plants, electrical grids.
So it seems like there's a real common thread here. This was discovered, they knew that this was going on even before the Iranian nuclear deal was made. So here we were in negotiations with this power that was making deliberate, aggressive cyber attacks against American targets. And we essentially ignored that and said, yes, we'll continue to deal with you as a negotiating partner in good faith, very much like the situation with China. Here we are contemplating with apparently serious intentions, the possibility of a Chinese state-controlled firm, or certainly with strong ties to the Chinese state, taking over the Chicago Stock Exchange, despite all kinds of evidence showing deliberate, aggressive attempts by China to infiltrate the United States through cyber espionage and cyber warfare. We just don't seem to learn our lesson. It's just amazing to watch this unfold. Well, thank you, Anthony. We have one final bit that we're going to talk about this coming June 23rd. The people of Britain are going to vote in a referendum on whether to leave the European Union. There's a quality piece of analysis this past week putting some of the concerns about leaving the EU into historical context. And to tell us about this, we'll turn to Richard.
Yes, Andrew Roberts is one of my favorite historians, and he makes a great point in an article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly. So much of the debate on Britain and Britain's place in the EU revolves around whether the country will be financially better off, and both sides go backwards and forwards on this. Both sides have their case. But Roberts makes the point that this is a very short-sighted way of looking at things. And to do that, he goes back to William Pitt the Younger and his staunch opposition to Napoleon. And here the nation could have chosen to make peace with Napoleon and kind of join the Napoleonic European system. But those leaders saw that that would have prevented, in the long run, Britain from being a great nation. And in that piece he wrote, instead, they recognized that it was only by preserving national independence and sovereignty and the supremacy of British laws that went with that, that national greatness could be pursued effectively in the long run. And so he goes through this parallel. And that type of thinking is just so lacking today. And it says a lot about our leadership that no one is really talking or thinking about the Brexit debate in those kind of terms.
Yeah, the point that really stood out to me was just something of a contrast in the character of the British people in the past versus today. And this statement that Prime Minister Cameron made that the absolute most important thing for us is economic security and financial security. Nothing is more important than protecting people's financial security. But he talks about how the people at that time were willing to undergo considerable financial stress in order to preserve their freedom. And you just wouldn't see that necessarily in the British people today.
No, you don't. And right at the end of this little section that we put in the Trumpet Weekly, we point to an article that Mr. Ron Fraser wrote back in 2000 called Britain's Final Decline. It's a bit of a long read. I'd completely forgotten about this this piece, but it's worth the read because it really is relevant to everything that Roberts is saying. And he actually weaves both of these themes together, actually. He talks about the leadership and how one of the main points we've made at the Trumpet is Isaiah 3 prophesies of a dearth of real leaders and strong leaders. And Mr. Fraser in this article ties that in to this lack of historical perspective. And this, just the way that history has been taught, the way that we view history has been changing, the way that the leadership responds to Britain's historical heritage is changing. And then he draws in the EU with that as well, and about how a lot of the European project aims to disconnect Britain from this history. And so it's really interesting to see this lack of, it's a very specific way that this lack of history, knowledge of history, has concrete results. And Mr. Fraser brings that out excellently in this 15-year-old article.
Thanks for that, Richard. And remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. All of the stories that we've been talking about on the program here are included within our weekly news report. We digest all of the most important stories from around the world and include them in this report, The Trumpet Weekly. We offer it to you every week, free in your email inbox. If you just go to thetrumpet.com, you can sign up and subscribe to this free service that we provide at The Trumpet. We'll finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Andrew.
Yo, had a new poll released just recently on just how effective the Obama administration's sanctions against Russia have been. You know, they introduced these sanctions after Putin invaded Crimea 2 years ago this month. And they said since they've introduced these, they said Putin's popular support has declined from 83% to 73%. They said apparently now only two-thirds of all Russians actually want Putin to run for a fourth presidential term in 2018. So it just really shows this how much these sanctions have changed Russia's behavior, which is almost not at all.
Devastating. Okay, we'll go now to Richard.
France arrested a terrorist in what they called the advanced stages of another terrorist plot. So that's already there's concrete proof that there are more terrorists out there. And the head of Europol said on Thursday that Europe is facing its worst terrorist crisis in 10 years right now. So concrete evidence that more attacks are on their way.
All right, we'll go to Anthony.
If you're a tourist visiting Iran, the government there might recommend its newest tourist attraction, and that would be statues of U.S. sailors who were captured by Iran earlier this year. They plan to make a monument out of it. In case you had forgotten about it, Iran wants to make sure you never forget about it.
So Iran actually is memorializing for all time what U.S. officials called routine nautical procedure.
Exactly.
All right, and back to Richard.
The German army wants more money. They've been cutting budgets for years and years and years. They reversed that increase a year or two back. That was a big deal, that decrease. And ministers agreed to increase the military's budget by $10 billion over the next 4 years this week. The army has come back and said that's not enough. So there's a clear change of mentality there, and it's not all cuts anymore.
All right, now over to Robert.
So in the latest sign that the global currency war is alive and well, money is fleeing China in an attempt to get out before central bankers devalue the yuan. Bloomberg reported on March 23rd that one-third of all houses purchased in Vancouver, Canada, over the last year were bought by Chinese investors. So last year alone, they dropped $9.6 billion on single-family homes in Vancouver. And because of that, the price of homes in Vancouver have skyrocketed 30% in 1 year. So there's a ton of hot money flowing into Canada. But the danger is, of course, hot money can flow out just as fast.
All right, back to Andrew.
Yeah, well, the Chinese news media has really criticized U.S. President Barack Obama for his outreach to Cuba. Not the fact that it happened, but the fact that he hasn't apologized profusely enough to the Cuban people for how he's wrecked their nation. Initially, it looked like the Chinese were really concerned that Obama was going to try to steal away their best friend in the Americas and their second most faithful trade partner. Although also just this week, Cuba's turned to China for another huge investment loan and just really reassured them that even though they're talking to Obama, they still like communist China best.
All right. Thanks for that. And over to Anthony.
Apparently, Bahrain is an Iranian province that was detached from the Islamic Republic of Iran due to Western colonialism. Those are the words of a commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and he was saying that we want Bahrain back. So even after all the talks with the nuclear negotiations, Iran has not been placated. It wants more.
Mm. And over to Richard.
Poland is not taking in any Islamic migrants. They had agreed to take in 7,000, but now after the Paris attacks, they've said that they don't want any more Muslims in their country.
All right, back over to Robert.
The U.S.-China trade gap is the biggest in world history. Amidst all the talk about Donald Trump starting a trade war, evidence has emerged that America definitely needs to do something. The Washington Examiner reported on a new analysis of U.S.-Chinese bilateral trade, and they found that it's not only at a historic high, but it's at the highest of any nation in world history. So in Donald Trump's own words, China is killing us at trade, and the numbers seem to support that.
Did you have another one, Andrew?
Yes, Russia announced this week that even though they have supposedly pulled out of Syria, they're ready to unilaterally act again if there are any violations of the ceasefire agreement. They've really criticized the American administration for not doing enough to withhold the ceasefire between Assad and his critics, and saying that if hostilities ramp up again, they'll be right back at it.
So much bad news. Does anybody have a bit of good news? Richard?
Yes, New Zealand kept its flag this week. This made me very happy. They spent years and a lot of money choosing and developing a new flag, and then they put it to the referendum, and there was a strong vote to keep the old one, with the Union Jack proudly flying up there on the top corner, and this link with Britain, with the Commonwealth, with the British Empire will now be maintained. And so that made me happy this week.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We would like to give you a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we talk about on this program are packed into The Trumpet Weekly every week. You can read it on your mobile device, on your iPad, or tablet. You can read it on your laptop. You can even print it out and read it on paper if you would like to do that. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Robert Morley, Anthony Chibatterway, Andrew Miller, and Richard Palmer. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having
me.
Good to be here. Great to be here.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Peter Hitchens: a nation is the sum of its memories, and when those memories are allowed to die, it is less of a nation. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.